want to talk to you about the basic materials which have to be handled in auditing. The basic things which have to be addressed in auditing. It's quite remarkable that these are today very simple, and if handled somewhat less than simple-mindedly, they produce excellent results. They have to be handled with intelligence. An auditor who should know better the other day took some of these materials and came back in and told me that he had run having this upon two cases, one after the other, and both of the cases had slumped. I thought that was fascinating, because this auditor's well-skilled should know better, but of course we know this auditor happens to be upset these days about something or other. And I questioned him and found out that he was running Mest Universe Havingness on one of the persons at a set ratio of 10 times. Look around here and tell me what you have. The first time he ran that, by the way, he combined 1 and 2. This was real poor. All right, now the next one was, look around, tell me what you could permit to remain. Some phraseology of that. And the third one, of course, is look around here and tell me what you could dispense with. And he was running it on a ratio of about 10, 5, and 1 at first, and then about 10, 5, and 3. And he was coming up on it on a mathematical scale of his, this is perfectly all right, but of his own devising without consulting the preclear. Now, that was quite fascinating. He wasn't consulting the case he was auditing when he did this. And he got his preclear up to a point where he was running the separateness end of this. Of course, you realize the separateness end, the what would you dispense with? What could you throw away? These are all synonymous actions. He had his preclear up to that point, and the preclear was anxious to throw away a great deal more than that. Well, there was nothing wrong with this, but the preclear was very happy about it. It could get rid of all sorts of things in the environment, and the auditor checked the preclear rather abruptly and would not permit the preclear to throw away those other things, but went back to running his mathematical ratio. And, of course, the preclear slumped. You see that? Next preclear on this line was run in a fashion which was quite similar. The mock-ups were shoved in, and then he said, I had to overcome a compulsiveness on the part of the preclear to release these mock-ups. They started flying away until it was obviously going to be very disastrous, and I had to check these mock-ups from flowing away. In other words, in essence, what had this auditor done? He had shoved in the preclear's anchor points by the process known as havingness. Got the difference. All right, to show you that some intelligence has to be used in these really just three elements, the very low down, low toned preclear does not flow in first. He throws away first, and on very low toned subjects, you'll find that the first action is not to have, but to dispense with. So the cycle runs, dispense with, let remain, accept. Now, this is sufficiently critical. Another auditor we had was running a case, a very bad-off boy that had never progressed beyond a certain age level, evidently, and was being treated as an invalid, was an invalid, couldn't handle the body, one side of his body pretty well paralyzed. And I told this auditor, speaking more or less at the age level of the patient, that he should take a ball and roll it toward the patient and have the patient stop it. We call this person a patient because this person was a medical patient. Roll the ball at the patient and have the patient stop it. Roll it at the patient and have the patient stop it. Roll at the patient and have the patient stop it. This auditor was very intelligent. He took my piece of advice there and saw that something was off the wheels and reversed the process, at which moment it worked. This patient was not stopped mentally at the age of 8 or 9, which will always accept and stopped and so gain havingness, you see. This person was maybe down there around 1 or 2 years of age. And a 1 or 2 year old, or an animal, or a dog, some kind, is on the waste or dispense with side of it, and they can only throw away. You want a little baby to get well into your processing, you pretend to, not so fast that it'll startle a child, but you pretend to draw back as though afraid. You know, withdraw. Approach very slowly and then withdraw just a little bit more rapidly. And the animal, the cat, the dog, the little baby, something on this order. I'm not saying a little baby's an animal. He's just been through the return lives area and he doesn't feel good about it. And he's upset for a couple of years, usually. Also, the immobility of the body keeps him upset. And so a withdrawal, then, is a lead out of the anchor point and is the waste end, the dispense with end, coming in first. Now, if you've done that for a while, of course, with a cat or something like that, you'd have to do this quite a bit before the cycle would then turn around and go the other way. But it would turn around and go the other way. So the cat would be overjoyed to have you charging. You could strike at the cat, and the cat would get up and purr. This would be a cat that was really coming upscale. Now, therefore, havingness, just as such, is in itself remedy of a subject which is handled with intelligence, with alertness. Watch it carefully. And when they want to dispense with it and want to throw it away and they seem to be running on that end of the cycle, you being very careful that they themselves do not completely obliterate themselves by doing this, let them do it easily and gently and so forth, let them dispense, you see. Otherwise, they'll go downscale. When they are running fine on accept, run them fine on accept. When they're running fine on remain, let them run on remain. But when they cross the border to do the next thing in sequence, for heaven's sakes, do it. Follow me? So it's something you handle with intelligence, and there's nothing will supplant an auditor's alertness to this. Now, one of the ways you are running a person out of havingness is very simple. You're running him out of havingness by his agitation and his unconsciousness. He becomes unconscious or agitated. Now, how do you tell if he's dispensing with too many? He sags in tone or turns on somatics. He doesn't necessarily get agitated or go unconscious. There's more to be known about this observation. There are more to be known about these symptoms. There's more to be studied on this. But the very best person indeed to study this would be yourself. Just what does the preclear do when he is dispensed with too many? Just what does he do to your own observation when he has to accept too many? Just what occurs when he lets too many remain in one place? Well, that's up to you to gather some experience on. Because he's going to do something, and that something will be explicitly in the direction of, I'm not as well off as I was a moment ago. So the common denominator of all these manifestations are simply that. He's not as well off as he was a moment ago. He's changed for the worst. Well, as he starts to change for the worst, you should change for the better. There's the time for an auditor to Q&A with a preclear. There's no other time. You throw in a communication bridge at that point, by the way. It's very interesting that you can do a communication bridge in a few seconds. Communication bridge is not 4 or 5 hours of yak. Or even, it's just, don't you think we've had enough of that now? Yeah, I think we do. How are you getting along? I don't know. I'm groggy. Well, that's fine. Let's change off now to this one. Is this command all right with you? I guess so. All right, do it. That's communication bridge. It has all of its elements. It's to taper off the process you were doing to get him a bit into present time You see, he is being audited. It isn't that dreadfully real. And to swing him over and get an agreement or a new contract on the next process you're going to run on him. You do that as you swing from one point to another, outflow, inflow, or remain in place, having this, you see. All right. With these words of alertness and this appeal to your observation, because you must observe early, you must observe his anaten before he does. You must observe his agitation before he does. You then should be able to profit very well along these three elements which are pertinent to the problem of auditing today. Now, I don't say there are only these three elements, but there may be other elements which are as yet undiscovered. I am being very adventurous to tell you that there are three elements in auditing, you see. We know there are three points of the ARC triangle. We know that. We know there's a tone scale. We know the no-to-mystery scale is pretty accurate. Now that it's been added to clear on down to hide and weight below hide, you might know, by the way, that from hide on down, it is weight. Nothing else below hide but weight. We know those things. We don't expect anything to ever appear and get added onto those things. But we do expect and rather believe that some compartmentation of these three elements will take place, or there may be additive elements. I just had the experience this morning of subtracting one element. So it's in a state of change to that degree. Problems are unpredictabilities. A problem is unpredictable. That's why it's a problem. And a problem at the same time is something that is hidden and causes a persistence. There's enough hidden ownership in it, or factors, or causative factors, to cause the masses to be hiddenly owned. Well, those things then go in under the heading of problems. And there aren't four, there are just three. Unpredictability is not a part of it. So you have freedom, havingness, and problems. And these are the three elements of auditing, which are run with attention to and on the basis of the cycle of action. See, you could say there are three levels out here on this level plane of equal or interchangeable importance, and those three are problems, freedom, and havingness. These are the elements. You neglect one of those, or throw one of those too badly out of balance, and your case bogs. I mean, if you don't keep them on a level, the pre-clear doesn't keep on rising. And you might say at right angles to these things, or to any one of these things, you have the create, survive, destroy elements. A pre-clear must be able to create problems. He must be able to destroy problems. He must be able to permit problems to survive. You take the matter of intelligence, for instance. An individual must be able to handle intelligence on the level of stupidity and tolerate it. An auditor who goes around going slowly mad simply because the pre-clear is so stupid is himself too intolerant of stupidity. Well, intelligence could be said to be the name of the level on which these three things exist. The smartness of the individual is his ability not really to just solve problems, but to pose and resolve problems. One of the first things we had in Dianetics, pose and resolve problems, function of the mind. All right? That is to say, create and destroy problems, isn't it? Well, there's another element right between the two. He must also be willing to let a problem remain. What problem can he walk off and leave? What outboard motor not functioning can he cease to fiddle with? You know? The situation, then, is a freedom of choice. And there are three elements in a freedom of choice. And one is the freedom to create it, the freedom to let it persist, and the freedom to destroy it. Those are the three factors of choice. And therefore, you have the create, survive, destroy curve that fits these three things. I mean, they're the same thing. So we have this about problems. Well, do we have it about havingness? Well, we certainly do. A pre-clear must be able to create havingness, by which we mean masses and energies existing in spaces. That's the definition of havingness, masses and energies existing in spaces. Havingness is not havingness if there's no space connected with it, you see, because it would not be located or positioned. And on the subject of havingness, he must be able to pose and resolve problems here, too, you see. But let's substitute the word. He must pose and resolve havingnesses. In other words, he must be able to create havingnesses, let havingnesses remain, and be capable of destroying havingnesses. He must do these three things to have a total power of choice on the subject of havingness, right? All right, now let's take this business about freedom. And we find that we have introduced into havingness a factor known as dispense with, or get rid of, or waste, or separate from some mass. And there we're talking about freedom, aren't we? So that particular facet of havingness has been included a little erroneously into havingness. You see, it's not really germane to havingness. It's about havingness, but the subject is freedom. So we have to have a freedom from, or a freedom with. And an individual then must be able to create freedom. That sounds strange to you, maybe, but he must be able to create freedom. He must let freedom exist. In other words, he must be a duck hunter, to be a good duck hunter, of a frame of mind that he's perfectly willing to let a flock of ducks fly by overhead without banging away at them. See, he must let those ducks remain free, or he must be perfectly willing to destroy those ducks. He doesn't have to destroy them, just assert his power of choice. That's proving it. Remember, I talked to you about proving this earlier. All right. So here we have create, survive, destroy problems. Create, survive, destroy masses and energies existing in spaces. And create, survive, destroy freedom. Now, freedom doesn't necessarily depend upon a space. Never make the mistake of believing that freedom is totally relegated to or dependent upon spaces. We graph the subject of freedom by saying space. See that? But freedom, in its final analysis and in its furthest limit, is not dependent on any space, any energy, or any mass. So we have unlimited freedom. So therefore, although havingness melts over toward freedom, to become an ultimate freedom, there would be no dependency on havingness of any kind in order to be free from something. See? So freedom belongs there as itself. It shouldn't be dispensed with, just on this basis that we have infringed the field of freedom with one of our activities of havingness. See, we dispense with something that's part, really, of both havingness and separateness. But separateness does not explain freedom either. Freedom explains freedom. And that's all it explains, freedom. It has no other limitation. If the word is to mean anything, it should be an unlimited word. So there are three elements on this level that must keep pace one with another. Now, you can see at once that freedom and power of choice, decision, postulate, and the cycle of action are all germane. They all have something to do with one another. They're very germane. You just say, create, and we know there has to be a certain freedom involved there. The factor is germane to any part of the cycle of action. But so are all of these factors, havingness, problems, and freedom, germane to the problem of life and the problem of handling livingness. And so is the cycle of action germane to it. Create, survive, destroy are the three strong points of the line. Now, you will discover that change has something to do with the cycle of action, and that change is an important factor on the cycle of action. An individual who is fixedly surviving is unwilling to change. A person who is either trying to get something to survive, or trying to survive, or trying to destroy something, is fixed on change, not survive. So, belonging between create and survive is a little interim condition known as change. And belonging to survive and destroy is a little interim condition known as change. And belonging between destroy and survive is a little interim condition known as change. And all of these factors have to do with time. Time has to do with change. So a cycle of action immediately includes in itself time. So the important things about the cycle of action is unchange, change, and time. The unchanged points are create. When an individual creates something, he may have effected a change from a moment before, but the fait accompli of the creation is now unchanging. Unless he has some time entering into it, at which time he has to create across a span of time if he wants this creation to keep on going pocket-a-pocket-a-pocket up the time track. It baffles many preclears to put a mock-up out in front of them and then not have the mock-up persist. The mock-up, believe me, is persisting in a moment of time which is now past. So we have to be able to put a mock-up up there which will walk up the time track. You see? Which means in itself a sort of a create-uncreate situation if we take separate instance of time, or just by postulate, it is there and will remain there as we go forward in the same time that I'm traversing, you see? And then we would have that object postulated with that postulate, then would be with us all the way up. Now, you understand there are really no mechanics below postulate, except the mechanics which are postulated. So what we're enunciating here, when we talk about these elements of the game, are, in essence, the postulates which have been used in full common by all life forms with which we have any acquaintance or will have. And we are examining their postulates. And what are their postulates? Their postulates are that life is a game. And, of course, this includes the postulate, I want a game. I want to be a participant in the game, and so forth. And this very high echelon postulate. Now, this doesn't immediately assume, from the standpoint of postulates, we're going to have space in which to play the game, or energy, or masses. See, it doesn't assume that. It's, I want to play a game. Well, now, how's he define game? Well, he wants to have some randomity. He wants to have some changes. He doesn't want this static knowingness forever. One of the things he does is immediately not know, then the other side, or not know this or that, or create some space, and he not knows that the space has been created. In other words, he's got several mechanical modus operandi of making a game. But these do not exhaust the subject. However, as far as life is concerned, they exhaust the subject for us. Because we know what life has done in order to create this game. We know that because the life units with which we are associated with because we have in common with them the same modus operandi for the creation of a game. You see that? You'd go into another universe, you would have another set of postulates which created their game. And you might be able to find something which didn't begin with the original postulate, must have a game, don't want a game, and that might be an entirely different setup, but you are not in communication with it in this universe or in your own. This we can be sure of, you see. All right, so therefore we're studying a set of postulates and an order of postulates which are germane to the people, the animals, and the universe in which we exist. And so, as they are germane to these things, we then have a pattern, which then apparently makes things awfully set, very, very unchangeable, awfully solid, you know, because everything is agreed on. And what we've done is reach up and strike at this high interweave of postulates consisting of time, space, energy, matter. The game consists of problems, it consists of havingness, it consists of freedom. Communication is the pay. The reward is in terms of next postulate. And what we have in common then is a universe, and we perceive it alike, and so forth. Well, knowing this is the case, We have a set of postulates which are in people so solidly, Bud, that I don't say you can't do this. For heaven's sakes, does not add any arbitrary limits here. It isn't usual for you to simply reach into your preclair as a thetan and flip a switch that knocks out one of these upper echelon postulates. You don't knock out one of these upper echelon postulates for the excellent, the very, very excellent reason that they, of all postulates, are solid, fixed. They're as fixed as he is in a complicated station here. Now, wherever we look for these postulates, however we examine these postulates, we find they are shakable. And an individual can get one of them shaken to his detriment. Some fellow walks along and says, I don't know what I'm doing here. He's just some fellow that's had his postulate about, I want a game shaken, you see. I don't want a game. I don't want to play in this thing anymore. I don't want to have anything more to do with this. I'm a lost soul. I'm a lost character. He's had this postulate fade out on him in some fashion or another. But the odd part of it is his conduct is still based on that upper postulate. He's still mournful because he doesn't want to play a game. He is assuming at once that he must be in juxtaposition to a game in some fashion. There must be a game around to protest against. He has omitted perhaps describing this in himself, but he responds to getting a game. And each one of these characters is playing a game. That's what's curious. We have a preclear, who is the bane of the director of processing's life. Why did this person ever happen? I'll tell you what this person's game is. In order to get well, I must be processed. I cannot be processed by any auditor you have. And the only thing that is making me sick is Scientology. Now, that's quite a game. The person doesn't even recognize it really as a game. But they're going on living and they're pockety-pocketing along the time track here. Nietzsche, please, playing this game all out, having this as auditors and auditing. Freedom is expressed as, I wish to be free from this problem and from Scientology. And the problem is I've got to be audited, I can't be audited. Scientology is the only thing that can rescue me. It doesn't do me any good. You see what the anatomy of that case is. Well, auditors auditing the case have rather cognited themselves that this was this person's game. And any effort to get them to get any new game is barred by the communication level of the preclear. Follow me? Communication level with the preclear is near psychotic. And just to get an auditing command through is a matter of an entire session. When this person turned up, wow. Wow. Auditor after auditor. It's as much as an auditor's reputation is worth to audit this person. He will just be cut to ribbons. He'll be reported to the association. He did the most terrible things. Rape isn't in it. One of the things, by the way, you don't want to pay too much attention to as a practitioner is the constant report from preclears of how bad that auditor is over there. The auditor might or might not have done the preclear any good, but I can assure you the auditor always did the best he could. It's been our consistent finding. Don't get too anxious about your fellow practitioner in Scientology because the preclears he's dealing with, by and large, are on the obsessed make nothing out of it. And if the auditor, by some familial interference or some such thing, can't get his hands on the case, get to the case, bring the case up tone and stabilize it, he is then in for it. You see, he's got to accomplish just that much at least. and yet you find these cases usually come from pretty batty families that are going to upset you. And the family itself, you finish off two-hour session, pre-clear feels fine, is talking sanely, comes back the next morning and going, duh, duh, duh. What happened? Well, the whole family jumped on him. One kid fell down the cellar stairs and busted a windpipe or something. And the husband kept him up all night arguing with them and telling them that they really didn't want to get better. And they were just doing all this, you see, just to get even with them. And they were just a batty environment. You know, and they come back to the next session, and here they go again. You run into that all the time. Every once in a while, somebody will tell you, well, Scientology did all this to me, and I'm in terrible shape because of this and so forth. Well, there's a possibility that here and there Scientology or Dianetics has really chewed somebody's head off. But this is totally excusable in view of the fact that this person's matched up with a good many thousands who didn't get their heads chewed off. And by the fact that there are an enormous number of people alive today simply because of Dianetics and Scientology. But you're going to hear this sort of thing and so on. For heaven's sakes, understand it from something like this game viewpoint. Preclear has a game. The game is I have to be a member of a psychotic family and try to get out of it. If they're not psychotic enough, I'll fix them up so they are a little bit. But our day of this happenstance and the generality of this occurrence, because it is not a rare occurrence, it's probably once every 25 pre-clears or something like that you run into it, the furnishing of new games by processing the elements of games themselves renders free from this odd liability. So we've got that one licked, and you'll see gradually the whole symptom in the field of treatment die out as we approach this. But we will never see a total end to it. There will always be those people who walk up to your front door, come into your group, and at that moment you said, mothers are not necessarily always good for children. And this person has immediately assumed that you're dead against all the mothers in the world, even though you might be a lady auditor and a mother, and we're saying something like this. They assume that you were. They go next door and say this person is preaching against the queen. There's always a certain randomity associated with it. Now, when a society in general is then put under duress on any of these three points of a game, you find games themselves dying out in the society. See, if they're under too tremendous a duress on any one of these three points, you find games dying out. If individuals cannot have problems, let's say, or if they can't make problems sometimes, or if they can't solve problems, I mean, from other people's duress, they're not permitted to make a problem ever. They're not permitted to have a problem unsolved, and they're not permitted to solve problems, just that, you're going to get an imbalance of games in the society. And if you deny people havingness by economics or some such mechanism, and if you enforce economics upon them as in a welfare state, welfare states are supposed to be so wonderful, that's just because we haven't forced any corn and games on anybody for a long time. It's fully as bad as the other. And if we insist then that these people have economic stresses, which they really cannot stand up to, it just in terms of mass, not even in terms of a problem. It ceases to be a problem when somebody says, your pay will now be $10 a week, or £3 or something like this, and your tax will be 50% of that, and the normal rent on quarters for a person such as yourself is, of course, $20 a week or £6. And this is the way it is. Believe me, that is not a problem. It's not even a catastrophe. It's just an isness, you see. And it becomes part of the reality of things. So that if havingness is this poor in a society, you get a reduction of games, having dropped one element. And if havingness, reversely, is too great, against the considerations of the society. You know, in Rome they used to ship all of they called it corn. It wasn't corn. It was some kind of wheat or barley or something of the sort. They shipped over from Egypt, and it was just issued to people. The Roman public finally in Rome itself got to a point eventually where it wouldn't even bake this up into bread. They had to establish public ovens and issue the grain baked in the form of bread loaves to everybody. They gave everybody everything. See, it was an effort to enslave a populace, and so they succeeded in doing so. The populace didn't have any game either. It went to the circus and watched people bumped off, and eventually it wasn't even doing this. Next thing you know, it was going to church wishing it could die. They were trying to find the map to a region where they didn't have to do anything and where nothing was anything and nothing. You see? That was the net result of this sort of thing. These socialistic societies that people come around and try to sell man on every once in a while are quite interesting societies, too, because they say in two breaths, they contradict themselves. They say, well, there will certainly be plenty of strawberries when we've got all the wealth apportioned. Somebody says, I don't like strawberries. And the socialist says, when comes the revolution, you'll like strawberries. My oldest wheeze on the line about that. But they intend to give everybody the same havingness. Well, people, from one person to the next, don't consider enough or too much in the same postulate breadth. It's everybody's opinion. Everybody has a different opinion on what is enough. I'm very amazed occasionally to see the difference of drink and what a person considers enough drink. It's fabulous. You go down in a pub, you'll see some of the lorry drivers or something in there, and they're getting enough to drink for lunch. And you'll see them take couple of pints. You say, enough to drink for lunch, 2 pints. Well, that's pretty good. I drink that many Coca-Colas, or I drink that much tea, or something like that. That's not so bad. And then they order the third pint, and you say, well, golly, that's quite a little bit. And when they order the fourth, you're getting so you don't quite believe it. Well, when they get to eight, you know very well, biologically, that the human stomach cannot hold 8 pints. They go out happily and climb in their lorry. They have enough to drink. 8 pints. Two. See? All right. You were standing there guzzling luxuriously maybe your half pint, you know. That was enough. Now you finished that up along with your lunch and you thought that was fine. And now we get a socialist regime. The socialist regime says, its first big error. It says enough beer is 3 pints per person per day. That's too much for you. You feel like you're having beer a little bit enforced on you, particularly if you had to appear, as you very often do in a socialist regime, in a certain line at a certain time to get 3 pints of beer. Otherwise, you're messing up the whole society. You see? You don't appear there. And the chap right behind you is grumbling and growling because he isn't getting 8 pints for lunch, much less for the day. And it renders a great deal of examination of this subject of havingness, and everybody gets puzzled and confused about the whole thing. No socialist regime can ever say how much enough beer is, you see. A little child might try to explain to you what enough play is or enough noise. You're liable not to agree with this. But the enough, which means the ratio between dispense with and receive and let remain, is, of course, a variant. And it varies everywhere. So is problems. Now, you can see that havingness is that much a variant. So are problems. One fellow goes along, boy, he's in glory. He's just having a wonderful time. He's maybe an engineer. And he has a strike on his hands, and nobody will deliver any of the material, and he's getting a penalty of £100 a day for every day that the building isn't erected, and he's having to deal with it one way or the other, and besides that, his wife is about to divorce him, and he's got a kid sick in the hospital, and so on. He seems to be a happy man. You talk to him, and he tells you all these things are going on, and so on. And how can this man be happy? It's impossible. In other words, he has enough problems to make him happy. And that's the truth of it. It's hard to reach that sometimes in a society that's had to solve everything all the time, or in us who have had to go to school for years and years and years and always solve everything put before us. If you were really going to train school children well, you would always give them a rack of problems they didn't have to solve. They would be quite obvious. You would at least let them have problems remain, and you would certainly add in a section of letting them create problems. Just like you would insist that they knew, and then give them a bunch of things that they could not know. You'd have to do that to keep them sane as they were educated. And they'd be pretty dynamic kids when they got through if you followed these things. But as we look over this whole situation of enoughness, the problem category that you will observe from time to time will, I'm sure, even though forewarned and so on, will occasionally startle you. Person come in, and they say, well, my husband was cross to me last night. And you say, that's fine. And this person is sitting there, and they just used up one pocket handkerchief, and they're reaching for another. And you say, this must be the first quarrel or something. There must be something else. He must have beat hell out of her. That's the least that happened. And then it must have been the first quarrel to have had this much bite, and You then discover that there isn't anything there but that. He was cross. Supper was a couple of hours late. He hadn't any sleep the night before. Everything was going to the devil, and the guy was cross. And you further investigate, and you find out he wasn't even cross at her. Well, that's just too much problems for this person. And don't attribute it to anything else with the person's consideration of how much a problem is. How much is enough problems? The engineer, with all that mass, seems to be perfectly happy he has enough, and she, with this little tiny problem, has too much. All right, now we look over on the matter of freedom, and we find somebody who has just been shoved out of the army or something. He ought to be very free, and he's not at all happy. He's miserable about the thing. Nobody telling him to get up or go to bed, and nobody placing him here and placing him there and telling him to do this. He doesn't know what to wear. He goes over and tries to pick out a tie, and he has the devil's own time trying to pick out a proper tie. His power of choice on an absence of ties, you see. The ties are all gone, so he has no power of choice on the tie left. The tie could pick him out. It has for years. It's been a khaki-colored tie or a black tie or something of that sort. That's picked him out for years. Now he has an assortment of ties that he bought in a wild, wasting enthusiasm immediately on his release, and he can't figure out which one to wear, and it ruins his whole day. His freedom. He's got too much freedom. One of the finest stories ever written on this subject, I don't think is in book form anywhere, was by Manuel Komaroff, who is one of our neglected modern authors. He wrote some very fine things. He has a fine book called Coronet, and a lot of other work. But the man is waiting to be found sometime in the next century. His popularity should be much greater than it is. Because he writes about life as it exists, and as he sees it, and as he digs it up and looks it over, and his artificializing of it is very slight. His artistic handling of it is quite great. And this chap wrote a story. His ability to perceive life is very, very fine. I suppose it's much better to read Elsie Dinsmore or something. But I don't find anything in life like Elsie Dinsmore. It's totally another universe as far as I'm concerned. He wrote this story about this old man who gets out of prison, and his son takes him in. And a nice other boy and his wife, take in the old man after the old man served practically all of a life term. And the old man finds out that they mean it. They don't mind having him there, and so all right. And he gets up to room, and after a few days or a few weeks, he finally establishes that they don't really mind what he does, and so he gets some board slats and nails up his closet. There might be mice in it or something, you know. It's too much space added to that room. And he really finds they really don't mind what he does, so he puts some bars across the window. And then by sitting in there all day with the door tight shut, he's pretty happy because he can occasionally see somebody on the roof of one of the apartment houses opposite who, if he pretends it right, can look like a guard, and that makes him feel quite secure. Now, this could happen. This could happen. A man has been trapped and caged to such an extent that he, of course, can tolerate no greater freedom than just the freedom of a cage. So where we have a fixed society that's fixed in certain boundaries and restrictions, and we are going to disturb just one factor in it, just one factor, freedom, in the society, and we're not going to disturb problems, we're not going to disturb or alter havingness, we're going to try to change freedom, we bring about chaos. In other words, we bring about what we should call, technically, a no-game condition. Get that as a technical line. It's a no-game condition. If a game is going to any degree, it can be improved. If it is altered incorrectly, it goes into a no-game condition. And a no-game condition is almost a point of no return. When you see somebody practically on his deathbed, you're looking at a no-game condition. When somebody keeps on getting sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker, and nothing you can do or anybody else can do anything for him, you're looking at a no-game condition. It's almost an absolute. It's the point of no return, actually. There aren't any problems present. No havingness. No freedom. In essence. But it's done this way. There's probably far too much havingness, far too little problem, you see, and some proportion of freedom is in error. Or there is no havingness to amount to anything. There are great problems or no problems. Or there's freedom to do anything you please, like a hobo has, you see. Or there's no freedom to do anything. There's something has happened there that brings about, again, only by the consideration of the person, a no-game condition, and he quits. And we know that emotion, and the emotion is apathy. We can produce apathy by altering the conditions of games so that we get a no-game condition. In other words, we can overwhelm his acceptance of one thing or another, or overwhelm his need to such a degree that we have an apathy. Now, to get anybody to move out of that particular apathy is a very difficult trick sometimes. The most difficult of these is, of course, the catatonic schiz, who simply lies in one place. Now, if you look at a catatonic schiz, not as somebody who won't move. See, that's so superficial an observation that it has never at any time helped any catatonic schiz. They don't move. They don't want to live. This is, again, superficial. A good definition is one which contains the solution in the definition. And that's an action definition. That's a good definition. Remember your old Dianetic axioms. Definitions of definitions. You could say a catatonic schiz is a person who is in a no-game condition. The moment that you place enough game or alter the elements in the environment to bring about a slight game condition, you will improve the catatonic schiz. I'll tell you one way a catatonic schiz was healed. A fellow suffering from what they called in that war shell shock, some lost war back early in the 20th century. They call it shell shock. And he was lying in the hospital, and he wouldn't move, and nobody could move him, and he's totally unresponsive, catatonic schizophrenia. All right. You don't have to worry about these horrible words. Don't go get upset about that. The word is absolutely meaningless. I don't think it refers to anything. It's just a person who's lying motionless and won't respond. It's another one of these unneeded definitions. Well, anyhow, catatonic schizophrenia was what he was suffering from, and the doctor came in and said, well, we've been given orders here, nurse, to evacuate the hospital, and we'll only be able to take just a few of these people. And you'd better put a screen here, because we'll have to dispose of these chaps. We won't dare let them fall into German hands. Nurse went over and got a screen. Doctor, of course, was all accoutred in military kit, as he would be in moving, and he pulled a gun out of the holster and checked its shells and so forth, and cocked it, and walked over to the bed, talking to the nurse very offhandedly, saying, all right, make sure that you get those instruments out of the next office in there, and so forth. Tell an orderly to come in here for this body, and grab the guy's hair and put the muzzle of the gun up to his temple, and the fellow got out of bed and said, I'm all right, don't shoot. Well, this was a smart changing the level of game. This was certainly changing the fellow's level of game. Guys stick in old games, which were good as far as they're concerned, just as easily as they stick in no game conditions. And where a person is stuck on the time track, he is stuck in a win or a lose. In other words, he's stuck in a no game condition either way. He won everything, everywhere. No game conditions. Give him a win. Later on, we find him. He's walking around. He's looking rather apathetic. You say, what's the matter? No, I don't know. I don't know. Like, you say, well, aren't you being successful? And so on. Oh, yes, yes. Being successful. Well, why don't you ever go out or do anything? I don't know. Get the idea. You're looking at somebody who's ambulant, who responds rapidly and so forth, but he's in a no-game condition. We trace his collapse back to a total win. He's in a big win. Something an auditor is prone occasionally to overlook. They're always looking for sickness to be at the root of all ills. I imagine some fellow who would be totally healthy all one lifetime would probably collapse in the next. No game condition as far as illness is concerned. All right. Now, he's stuck in a win. No game condition. So, they equally, however, produce the same manifestation, apathy. And that is a big lesson we've learned lately. Big lesson. We always kind of known that guys could be stuck in wins, but not precisely how this occurred. It precisely occurs just along this one line. An imbalance of these three factors. A fellow who is having a good game has enough havingness, enough problem, and enough freedom from his viewpoint. That's why you don't look at a case and say, I now know what is wrong with you, George. You have now got to do this and that. See? Senseless to evaluate for them. Only they know what is enough havingness. But we, by handling the three elements, we can change the person's mind. Now, his change of mind depends upon getting the three elements changed proportionally in relationship to each other. So you can change one and ruin the other two, because they're interdependent. You could change two and wreck him on the third. Now, you wouldn't ruin him. You'd simply park his case somewhere, and his case would stick right there. His case sticks always at a point where one of these three factors has gone out of order with the other two. And to take any case that is stuck or has been audited just so long and has then not made any progress further in auditing is to find which of these three things was missing at that point. Freedom. That would be a stick, you see. Not enough freedom. Problems. Too much problems, maybe. Too little problems at that point in auditing. You know, you could key in a dozen facsimiles, one right after the other, on a preclear, and just stick his case right there. Why? You've given him too much problems in having this and too little freedom. By the time he had churned up the second one, he would have been saying, I don't think it's wise to do this. I feel uncomfortable, he would have been saying. He would have been saying something to indicate, I don't think this is wise, you know. And we would have said, oh, no, no, key in another one. No, key in another one. Fellas, I don't really like to do this. I really don't. Well, now, come on, you know what's good for you. After all, I am the auditor around here. Key in another one, see? And if you'd made that good with him, you would have restricted his freedom to that degree that another auditor or yourself would have to go back and pick up that case at that point where the freedom was restricted and restore sufficient freedom. The oddity is that restoring freedom is very easy. There's nothing much to it. Separateness run against havingness. Will work him out of too little freedom every time. You can work it over on the havingness side very easily because separateness is really part of havingness. It's not really part of freedom, but it looks like freedom. And they will take off into freedom by having separateness run. So you've got the little gradient there that boosts them up. You know this fundamentally and mechanically. To get a person unstuck in the time track, all you would really have to do would be to run enough separateness. But if you run too much separateness, at once he will suddenly go low on havingness, and so we would have to run some havingness into him to run some separateness further on him, you see? All right, now we would get along beautifully, and all of a sudden we're liable to find him bogging. We're liable to find the case bogging again. And this is one of the odder bogs. One of the odder bogs. We had a girl, a very lovely lady, an auditor, professional auditor. She got audited nicely, stable, exterior, beautiful condition, nothing wrong, nothing. Beautiful shape. Lived that way for about 2 months. All of a sudden realized she was out of communication with all of her friends. This is what she said. So she immediately got herself into more trouble than you could shake a stick at. Messed up her case in all directions. What had happened? The person had not been audited up to stable on these 3 points. The person was merely stably exterior with no problems. No problems. Oh, wow. The least she would have done was to have rehabilitated the person's ability to solve problems. And nobody did that with her, even vaguely, because she was audited a long time ago and we didn't know too much about it. But that's what she did. And she just messed herself up royally. And recently ran into this again and was run on enough invented problems. And she came out nice and smooth. And she's stable exterior and having a good time now. In other words, you could audit a person toward no game. And the way you would do this would just be to unbalance these factors. Now, by holding these factors in proper balance as you audit them, they get greater and greater ability to have a game. And that's the overall thing that they gain. That's the one thing they really gain. By auditing these 3 factors of havingness, freedom, and problems, they gain in their ability to have, which is really not a mass, a thing called a game, which is the excitement of life, the thrill of life. Things look good. They can be excited about things and so forth again. They can have different emotions, so on. Now, as they come up the scale, then, they are very often parked, you might say, by neglect of one of these 3 factors. Therefore, whatever auditing procedure you are using, it would be a very poor job of auditing if you were not alert to the existence of these 3 factors and if you didn't repair them easily. Now, problems are all very well, just all by themselves, so is havingness, and so is freedom. But remember, there is a cycle of action connected with these things. Create, remain, and destroy. And that's not necessarily totally on havingness, totally on problems, or totally on freedom. We must be able to do these 3 things. So if you draw this up as a scale and graph it, you will have a rather large number of processes. The one thing that goes down with an individual is the first end of the cycle, create. So that one you would have a tendency to specialize in. But you can only specialize in that so long, and then you have to go on to remain and destroy, or survive and destroy, you see. You have to keep those 3 in balance while keeping the other 3 in balance. Now, this doesn't look very complicated, really. It might look complicated at first, but you find it's very easy to do because the condition is always, as you get a little better look, very, very obvious to you. person starts having a problem. And nothing really gets them off the problem. They're certainly short problems. Now, you say that an individual must be free to have a game. Well, there's the whole emotional tone scale. He should be able to invent every one of those emotions. Do you know that? Because some of the problems he has, in fact, all of them, are to some degree bound up in the emotional tone scale. His problems might be rather esoteric. They might be rather strange. They might be rather hard to reach unless you know enough to have him invent problems. You can have him invent problems about anything. You can have him invent problems about the eight dynamics, preferably terminals. About as light as you can go is to have, in terms of no masses, is to have him invent problems about emotions. But you would do that with this way, invent something to be afraid of, which is in itself one of the hotter processes. Invent something to be apathetic about. Invent something to be angry about, and so forth. Freeze up his emotions. But this is merely a rank of problems which might be hidden from you if it isn't pointed out. He is making, out of emotions, a set of problems. And you get him around that particular set of problems by having him invent the emotions themselves as something doing this or something doing that. And you can get him to move on the emotional tone scale as you come up. And I rather believe today that it is necessary to handle some of that and to remember some of our old processes, like put some fear in the wall or something on that order, in order to push him on up the emotional scale. So we can handle these three main factors in balance against the create, survive, destroy scale. And remembering, when we say upscale, we mean up the emotional scale. So don't neglect the emotional scale that we're trying to push him up. And in such a wise, you will make yourself some clear pre-clears. That's a cinch. A clear pre-clear today is only somebody who responds at the rate of about 100% plus on all desirable human characteristics and who is minus on all undesirable ones. And that person can be made. His IQ is about 150, and he is exteriorized if he responds in that fashion. So we can test a clear today. Clear is very easy to create within those lines. But he's only created if you rehabilitate his ability to play a game. Thank you.